next to the tub sink. That's a great idea, using a rain barrel for running water. Thanks. It was one of my first fixes to the no running water problem. This house is great for the winter, but no water is kind of a pain. I doubt we would have running water if we were in a normal house. It's been so cold, the pipes would have frozen at some point along the way. She paused. Oh, if you have to use the restroom, we have an outhouse right next to the back door. It's cold, but not as bad during the day when the sun heats it. It's right next to the house. She pointed towards the back door. Not too far a walk. Rebecca, how old are you? Paul was the only one talking. Hank was too confused and flabbergasted to engage. I'm 13, but I have a birthday in April, so I'm practically 14. And you and Greg live here by yourselves? No one else is here, Paul asked. I know. I look young, but I'm pretty driven. Yes, we came here in November, as I said, and were able to set up this house before it got too cold. We tried the other house, the one you all grew up in, but it wasn't practical. There was no way we could heat the rooms. It was too big. Greg remembered this cottage. His mom made him take a tour one summer. It's perfect. She stirred the soup, which boiled quickly over the already hot wood stove. There's a rack we put up for drying clothes. She pointed towards a wooden dowel with several plastic hangers. See the hangers? You can put your wet clothes up there. Things dry quickly in the kitchen with the wood stove. Paul walked over to hang his winter clothes on the line. Hank stood in his full gear, unsure about what to do. May I ask a favor? Rebecca said, looking at both of them. Paul, focusing on hanging his clothes, answered, Sure.
Can I give you hugs? I'm so happy to see you.
Greg talks about you endlessly.
I didn't believe you could be alive. It's been so hard doing all this by ourselves.
Her composure was gone. Despite her high IQ, the 13-year-old girl came through. She started crying as she stirred the soup. Hank, a father to four, knew what to do for the first time since he walked through the front door. He walked over and put his arms around her. As glad as you are to see us, we're even more excited to meet you. It's okay. You don't have to do this alone anymore. Paul and I are here. Rebecca held him tightly, wiping tears and her running nose against his jacket.
I'm so sorry, she said, jumping back. I snotted up your coat.
Rebecca, I had four daughters. You just made my year. I miss moments like this. You can snot up my shirt, coat, or sweater anytime you want. You're part of the family now. He held his arms open for her to give him another hug. Rebecca was sobbing uncontrollably. She stepped into his arms to continue their hug. Rebecca savored the hug for several moments. She backed away, taking a tissue from her pocket to wipe her face. Hank unzipped the jacket and hung it on the drying rack. Rebecca poured the soup into two bowls and handed each of the men a spoon.
Do you want to eat in here or in the living room?
Paul, what do you think? I'd rather stand in here and eat. I've been hunched over that snowmobile for over 2 hours. Hank stripped down to his base layer of khakis and a long-sleeved silk shirt he found in a Rutland sporting goods store.
Yeah, stretching out a little sounds great.
Paul took the soup off the counter.
Thank you, he said genuinely.
And to answer your question, we came from Rutland this morning. We've been stuck there since mid-December, trapped on the other side of the mountains after the first big snow. We decided to pack up and make a try at coming over on snowmobiles, and, well, it worked. He took a sip of soup, and his insides warmed instantly. I'll be honest, it was kind of fun, too. At least until my face was so cold it felt like it was going to fall off, then not so much fun.
You've been over at Killington this whole time? That's amazing. We heard a gunshot back in November. Was that you?
Rebecca hoped to solve the mystery of the lone gunshot. Not us. But that gives us hope there are other people alive. I mean, not more hope than meeting you, since you're a non-Dixon survivor. Hank took big slurps of soup between replies.
I didn't realize you were so hungry. Would you like some bread? We have half a loaf from last night. I can toss it in the oven to warm up.
Rebecca noticed the speed with which Hank was eating. I'll take it room temp. I'm starved. Is there any jam or jelly? He asked. Rebecca retrieved both from a cabinet.
Fortnum and Mason strawberry preserves. Where did you get this?
Hank held the English preserves in his hand.
There was a Williams-Sonoma at the Concord Mall. I cleaned them out after the rapture. I have a bunch of their pancake and waffle mixes, too.
She smiled at his excitement.
You're a keeper. You can stay.
Well, I guess this is your house, so of course you can stay, but I mean as part of the family. They laughed as Hank ripped off a piece of bread. He stared at the chunk for a second, stunned by the realization it was made by either a 13- or 14-year-old. Paul continued to tell Rebecca about how they connected in Dayton, rode almost the entire way to Hanover, were trapped in a B&B in Rutland, and spent the last 2 months gorging on gourmet food and playing cribbage. When the storms appeared to break for a few days and they practiced riding the snowmobiles enough, they made their attempt to Hanover.
How did you get here? How did you meet Greg?
Paul asked between bites of bread. I know we're going to have a lot of time together, but I have to hear all the stories of meeting, getting up here, selecting the house. This is all amazing, and for two teenagers to accomplish it? Unreal. She started from the beginning, as the men stood and listened in awe of what they heard. Rebecca was a talker. She was more than happy to tell her story. Every once in a while, Hank or Paul would interject with a question. How did you think to do that, or why did you make that decision? It was a fun story. One that, of course, had a happy ending. The bathtub was a wonderful surprise. We both loved taking that first bath, but then the water sat in the tub for 4 days, gray and nasty, before Greg finally said, I'm drilling a hole in the floor. We'll just drain it right into the bottom of the house. It worked perfectly. We attached a piece of hose to the tub drain and threaded it through the floor. After 45 minutes of stories, the three cleaned up the kitchen. Paul and Hank asked where they could store all of the supplies they brought on the sleds attached to the snowmobiles.
Well, this is your house now, too. You don't have to ask permission. We can unpack your supplies into the dining room. I want to take an inventory before we put it in storage. We need to have a conversation about where everyone is going to sleep. The downstairs bedroom is the best option, but there are only 2 beds in there. We should consider finding bunk beds in one of the other houses so the 4 of us can sleep in there. It makes more sense to have 1 fire going at night rather than double our wood consumption heating 2 bedrooms. At least, as long as neither one of you snores. She flashed a smile. Paul was amazed at Rebecca's planning. Her intelligence was far beyond that of a regular 13-year-old. She actually asked to inventory their supplies.
Let's get unpacked, wait for Greg to get back, and we can decide on where to go for beds. You're right. We have another 3 months of fires, and while there's plenty of wood, there's no reason to waste it. Paul and Hank grabbed their gloves and caps, opened the front door, and walked outside to unhook the supplies from the back of their sleds. Greg was next to the snowmobiles, his shotgun pointed towards the door. He was crouched behind one of the machines, resting the gun on a seat. The barrels were aimed at the men.
"Hold it right there!" Greg yelled. "Greg, it's your uncles! They made it!"
Rebecca poked her head between the 2 men. Greg dropped the shotgun and ran towards them. He put an arm around each uncle and hugged tightly. They stood in the cold, embracing. No one spoke. Greg wept.
I knew you were alive. I knew it, he finally said. And if you're alive, that means the rest of the family is alive.
He hugged tightly, refusing to let go. Hank and Paul were confirmation that Greg's father and brothers were alive.
Greg, I don't have a coat on, and it's really cold out here. Can we go inside?
Hank broke the hug.
Oh, God, yeah, I'm sorry.
His eyes were red, and his face was wet from crying.
You met Rebecca? She saved my life.
Paul smiled.
We've met. She filled us in, gave us a great meal. Very nice girl. Wait a second.
Greg walked back down the 2 front steps and to the sidewalk cleared by the snowblower. He bent over and picked up a string with 3 animals tied to it.
3 squirrels today. That's the most I've gotten in 1 outing. I should have known there would be more people arriving. How crazy is that?
He walked into the house and looked at Rebecca. I told you they were alive. I believed enough for the both of us, and you kept me alive. Greg cleaned the squirrels out on the trail. It was the reason he was gone for more than his typical 1 hour. Greg strode past his uncles. He put the squirrels into a pan, drizzled them with olive oil, salt and pepper, and put the pan in the oven. His boots were in the shoe bin by the front door, per Rebecca's house rules, but he was still in his coat. He washed his hands in the sink before turning back to his uncles. Paul and Hank were stunned. Their 14-year-old nephew took care of his business before moving forward with pleasantries. Greg had transformed into a survival expert during the last 5 months. Managing the food was more important than conversation.
Okay, so what's going on? How did you get here? Where were you? Have you spoken to my father or heard anything else?
Paul and Hank brought Greg up to speed on their last 3 months. We can talk about the rest of the world, the rest of the country later, Hank said in conclusion. Rebecca caught us up on your lives. When was the last time you spoke to your father?
I spoke to him right after your call, the one about coming up to Hanover. He said my mom was sick, but no one else, so I think my brothers are okay. He just said to stay alive, get to Hanover, and he would be coming for me.
Greg looked at Rebecca.
With her help, I've kept my end of the bargain.
Well, we've got 3 or 4 more months to go, but we'll make sure we keep your promise, Hank said to him. Not that it appears you need much help from us. We might actually pull you down a bit with 2 more mouths to feed. They sat on the sofas in front of the fire.
By the way, Paul cut in, this is the most comfortable sofa I've ever sat on. I know, right? We found it in a house on Ockham Pond. It almost killed us getting into the van and over here, but it was so worth it.
Rebecca nodded. Let me get a sit. Hank was on the other sofa with Greg. Is it really that nice?
Hank, you'll be stunned. It's like sitting on a slice of heaven. It's firm, but comfortable.
Whatever happens, I think we need to take this couch with us.
Hank sat down on a couch. Darn. This is nice. I could get used to this.
Rebecca stood so Hank could swing his feet up and lay down. He put his head on one of the throw pillows and was asleep in seconds.
It was kind of a long ride up here. I think it took it out of my brother, Paul said. Let's go in the kitchen so we can grab a snooze. He has this new philosophy of taking life easy. No stress. No apologies for napping.
Rebecca scrunched up her face at Greg with her, what the heck? Did that just happen? Look, as she followed Paul into the kitchen.
The roasted squirrel was out of the oven and was resting on the counter. The light faded as the sun dipped. It was 4:30 p.m. Paul, Greg, and Rebecca talked for hours.
Hank and I will sleep on the couches tonight. We'll have to keep 2 fires going for one night. We can find and secure bunk beds tomorrow.
Is he going to be able to fall asleep tonight if we let him take a nap now?
Rebecca looked towards the living room. Don't worry, it will be my problem. You 2 can go to sleep in the bedroom, Paul assured her.
Greg pulled canned peas and carrots from the pantry, along with chicken stock, instant potatoes, and stuffing. Let's have a feast. This is a true celebration day. Maybe the food will wake Uncle Hank.
They enjoyed a homecoming supper that evening. Paul told the story of the filthy caveman Hank emerging from his hole in the ground. Rebecca had the uncles rolling as she talked about Greg trying to bag a turkey with a garden hoe. Their stories lasted late into the night.
Thank you, Greg said to Rebecca quietly. His head was propped up on his hand. He looked at her as she faced him in the same pose.
He stretched out his hand, and she grabbed it. They squeezed hands together.
You were welcome, Greg Dixon from Hightower.
He squeezed her hand again.
Don't think we aren't still Team Greg and Rebecca. We're a group of 4 now, but I have your back. I'll always have your back, just like I know you have mine.
He did not drop his eyes.
Don't ever think I won't have your back.
She smiled.
I know.
She closed her eyes, still holding his hand.
I know.
Greg opened his eyes and rolled over the next morning to find Rebecca staring at him. Their fire was out, and the room was cold.
It's about time you got up. Put on a robe and start the fire in the kitchen. I'm freezing, and I don't want to get out of bed until I know it's warm in there.
Okay, okay. Just keep the covers over your head, and I'll call you when it's warm. Greg got out of bed and put on a thick fleece L.L. Bean robe, slipped his feet into his fleece slippers, and opened the bedroom door. He was met with a blast of warm air. His uncles were up, and the main house was warm.
Looks like they beat us up. The house is warm. What a nice treat.
Greg did not wait for Rebecca. He walked through the house to use the bathroom outside the kitchen. He said good morning to his uncles as he hurried to use the facilities. When he came back through, he saw them cooking sausage from the food they brought on their sleds.
"Weren't there any eggs?" Greg asked.
"Eggs? From the Easter Bunny? Where are we going to get eggs?" Hank asked as he ate sausage off his plate.
"From the chickens we have in back. Did we not show you the coop attached to the house?"
Greg went to the door leading to the coop. He was followed by Paul and Hank. Greg grabbed a basket off a hook next to the door. He opened the roost, gathered the 10 eggs available that morning, thanked the chickens, and told them he would be back to feed them in a minute.
"You hunt squirrels, and you have chickens," Paul said flatly.
Rebecca came into the kitchen and saw the lone plate of sausage.
"No eggs this morning?" she asked.
26. Todd typed 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C. into the GPS on the RV dashboard. The satellites circling the Earth were still functioning, and the GPS was based on a preloaded hard drive. The directions to the White House were flawless. Dusk was settling onto the capital city when they pulled up to the building. A tall iron gate blocked the entrance. Todd picked up a walkie-talkie and called John.
"You think I should just put the front bumper against the gate and floor it slowly? We should have enough horsepower to get me through, right?"
"Nothing to lose but the bumper. Maybe the front tires if spikes pop up or something."
"Spikes?" Todd said to Emily.
The boys rushed to the front window to see the action.
"Are we going to ram it?" Brian asked. "Let's ram it!"
"Ram it! Ram it!"
the boys started chanting.
"I'm not going to ram it. I'm going to gently push it open."
He paused.
"If I can."
He edged the front of the RV past the empty guard shack and against the gate.
"Ready? Everyone hold on to something."
He pressed the gas. Nothing happened. The engine revved. He pressed down and the gate suddenly broke open. The RV jolted forward as the iron gate swung violently to the side. Todd took his foot off the gas and the vehicle coasted to a stop. Todd looked towards Emily. The RV and all of its passengers were fine. Only a few items had fallen off the counter.
"Welcome to the White House, kids," he announced with a smile.
"Nice work," John called through the walkie-talkie.
Todd moved the RV up the driveway to the White House, parking next to an overhang with a wide set of stairs. A red carpet led into the house. The rug was badly stained from the winter weather.
"This must be where the President and First Lady got in and out, covered to keep rain and snow off. See the red carpet with the big seal on it, kids? Are we going to eat? I'm starving."
The word starving was emphasized by a dragging of its pronunciation. Jay was not fun when he was hungry.
"We're having spaghetti and meatballs.
Let's do it."
Todd developed a recipe for meatballs from cans of beef chili. He made a batch while they were in Richmond and left them simmering in the pasta sauce. He was lucky the sauce had not fallen on the ground when they breached the gate. Todd poured water into a pot and turned on the burner.
15 minutes until dinner. Why don't you three go out and play soccer on the White House lawn? Maybe walk the dog."
Hubba was thrown out of his bed during the gate opening. He sat by the RV door waiting.
"And make sure you pick up his poop this time," Todd said to Craig.
There was enough daylight left to kick a ball around the lawn. Brian grabbed the glow-in-the-dark soccer ball they had for just such occasions and ran out the door. With the water on the stove and the meatballs and sauce bubbling, Todd walked out of the RV with Emily to talk to John, Matt, and their newest tribe member. Todd was too late to speak to Solange. Jay co-opted her to play soccer, and she was off with the boys, kicking the ball around.
"That was an easy trip," John said.
I've never gotten to D.C. so quickly. This no-traffic thing has its benefits.
How's the new girl? Todd asked.
She's sharp. She has a great idea of shooting fireworks off both here and in New York. She said they would be more effective than the horn and smoke. She earned her dinner tonight. Where we get fireworks, I have no idea, but it's a good plan. I think even a flare gun would work. Maybe we can use the GPS to find a boating supply store.
Emily nodded.
Matt seems to like her addition.
John smiled. Yeah, he does. But I don't think she's seeing it back. She may be only 27-ish, but she's mature. It takes guts to leave your family and come to the States. And to endure what she's had to? I'm not saying she's out of his league, but I think she sees herself as more our peer than his. Anyway, that's the vibe I got during the last 2 hours. He looked towards her, kicking the ball with his son. I trust her. She's open about herself, and she's a keen observer. She knows the shitstorm we're all in, and she knows we have a long road ahead. This isn't some sort of picnic.
High praise coming from Mr. Trust No One. Emily gave John's arm a soft punch.
Spaghetti and meatballs tonight. I'm about to drop the pasta. Let's plan on 6 to 7 minutes.
Todd went inside to finish dinner. He made 3 boxes of thin spaghetti, more than necessary in case anyone showed up for dinner. Todd was wary of cooking extra and unneeded food, but knew he could serve pasta as leftovers the next day.
8 minutes later, he rang the dinner bell. The food, a large bowl of meatballs next to a larger bowl of pasta with red sauce, was presented on the RV eat-in kitchen table. They used plastic plates, cups, and utensils to minimize the dishes and water use.
Todd handed Solange a plate.
Please, go through the line first. I don't know how well you've eaten, but I hope you enjoy your first meal with us. Do us the honor.
Jay stepped forward.
I'll show her how to do it.
He grabbed a plate from his father.
It's a buffet. You walk through and grab what you want as you go.
That's buffet, dear, Emily corrected her youngest, who had a tendency to make up words that were almost correct.
Buffet, yeah, come on, I'll show you.
He touched Solange's hand. She let him lead her to the table of food. Solange smiled at Jay.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, too, she said to Todd over her shoulder.
They sat in the RV. Emily and Solange shared the love seat, and the 4 boys used the dining table. Todd and John sat on the sofa. The evening's darkness dropped the outside temperature into the 50s, preventing them from eating outside.
This is delicious, Matt said to his uncle. How did you make these meatballs? Where did you get the meat?
You have to get creative when your sources of protein are limited. I take canned chili, the mildest I can find, and mix it with breadcrumbs from yesterday's bread. Break a few eggs, Italian spices. They firm up nicely and resemble meatballs. It stretches a few cans of meat into a meal for all of us.
I swear I taste cheese. Where did you get cheese?
Matt was the cook in his group and was eager to learn.
Oh, yeah, I added some goat's milk ricotta. I made that the other day for a lasagna, and I had a little left over. Thought it would go well. I found a cheese-making book and started using the goat's milk to make ricotta and mozzarella. When we get settled, I can show you how to make the fresh cheeses that don't need aging. It's pretty easy, though it does take quite a bit of milk.
Solange sat next to Emily. She barely touched her food.
Are you okay, Sol?
Emily asked.
I am overwhelmed. You are all so nice, and you have accepted me so easily. I have not spoken to anyone in 6 months. I am grateful. Please forgive me if I cry. It is hard to describe. I am relieved and happy to have found you, or be found by you.
Emily put her arm around the young woman.
Take all the time you need. We understand.
She calls soccer football, Brian said loudly. She said soccer is called football in Ecuador. That's weird. What do they call football, then?
It's Ecuador, and they don't have football in Ecuador. They play soccer and baseball and other sports, but not football. Football is just an American sport.
Well, and Canadian, I guess, Todd told him. Soccer is called football in every other country but ours. We are the weird ones.
Oh.
Brian tried to process the information. He had a confused look on his face.
Are there even other countries anymore?
The adults looked at each other. Emily responded after an awkward pause.
I don't know. I guess not.
We are probably all in this together.
A voice called from outside.
Hello? Is anyone in there? Hello? My name is Peter Reinhardt. I saw your lights.
The people in the RV froze. John's hand went to the gun on his hip.
Really, John?
Emily said. It sounds like an older man. She stood and went to the door. She walked over a sleeping Hubba and quipped,
Again, great watchdog you've become.
Emily, hold on, Todd said. She looked over her shoulder and shook her head.
Do you not understand either? We are all in this together, everyone.
She opened the door.
Hello.
She wore the same smile she did when Solange drove towards them in Richmond.
My name is Emily Dixon. Welcome.
The door of the RV was on a spring. It closed behind Emily as she walked outside. The last thing the inside group heard was,
Hello to all of you.
Todd jumped up and leapt the few steps to the door. He opened it to find Emily shaking the hand of an elderly man, probably in his late 60s or early 70s. He was accompanied by 4 people, 3 children and a woman. None of the people looked to be related. The woman was Asian. The older man was Caucasian. 2 of the children were African-American, and the last child, a younger girl of approximately 3 or 4, sported beautiful red hair and freckles. The Dixon group lined up behind Todd.
Todd, come meet the people,
Emily said to her husband as he stepped out of the RV.
Everyone, come out. It's okay.
The Dixons and Solange stood by the RV. An awkward silence fell over the 2 groups.
Hello. I'm Todd Dixon, Emily's husband. Very nice to meet you. This is our family.
Todd made introductions and included Solange as part of his family, though she was just 5 hours into her tenure with the tribe. Peter was 68 years old. Melanie, or Mel as she preferred, was 37. Jacob and Jacqueline Jones were 8-year-old twins. Casey Frank just turned 4 years old. She was shy and clung to Peter's leg, peeking out from behind the tall man. Jay, the child ambassador of the group, walked over to her and said simply,
My name is Jay Dixon. Want to be my friend?
The little girl nodded and shook Jay's hand.
We have spaghetti and meatballs inside. Would you like some?
How about you guys?
He offered food to Casey and the Jones twins. Casey nodded and looked up to Peter.
It's okay, Casey. You can trust them.
Peter gave the little girl's head a pat.
Go ahead. You all can.
I made enough pasta for everyone.
Todd went back in the RV to assist the children.
It's cold out here. You're welcome in our RV. It will be a little cramped, but it's warm and there are lights. We offer you anything we have that you might need.
Emily opened the door.
I'd love to come inside. It's freezing out here. I don't like the cold,
Melanie said quickly. Emily followed to help manage the 6 young children inside waiting to eat dinner.
John, is it? Peter asked. Where did you come from, and where are you going?
John appreciated the blunt questions. We drove from Raleigh. I'm originally from Charleston, joining my brother a month ago. We're headed to New Hampshire to meet my 3rd son and my 2 brothers. We're stopping in cities along the way to meet survivors, invite them to join our group. We hope to gain strength through additional numbers and increased skill sets. If Peter was going to ask straightforward questions, John would give no-nonsense answers.
Well, John, as far as I can tell, having searched for the last 2 months, you were meeting all the Washington, D.C., Annapolis, and Baltimore survivors. We're glad to meet you and your clan. I can't speak for the group, but I'd like to hear more. I'm too old to keep caring for the twins and that little cutie.
Peter looked tired. He was clean-shaven. His complexion and waistline were healthy, but his eyes wore dark circles from stress and lack of sleep.
I was an airline pilot for 30 years after serving as a Navy pilot. I retired 8 years ago with my wife. She taught at Georgetown. She passed this fall from the rapture.
We returned from a trip to Virgin Gorda before all hell broke loose. I was almost trapped down there. I guess that wouldn't have been so bad, although I don't think they have much fresh water. He paused as he thought about the Caribbean and his last vacation with his wife. Anyway, I'm a hard worker. I just can't work that long anymore. Peter, it's great to meet you. My son Matt and I have been living in Charleston for the last 10 years. His mother passed from the rapture. I don't know how or why, but my three boys and I are immune. I owned a small company in South Carolina that paid our bills. Matt is a smart young man. He contributes more to the group than I do most days. John put his hand out and patted Matt on the shoulder. The pride John had for his son was obvious. My youngest brother Todd and his wife are both immune, as are their kids. I'll be a son of a gun. A married couple who both survived? Peter could not believe it. I know. Insane that Todd and his kids survived. But his wife Emily, too? It makes no sense. But we're thankful for it. I have two other brothers, both from Ohio, meeting us in Hanover, New Hampshire. They were still alive and healthy when we spoke to them last fall. We grew up in New Hampshire, and it was the last place we mentioned before the phones went out. Our long-range plans do not involve Hanover, but our short-term plans are firm. My middle son, Greg, was at prep school when this all happened. He was alive when I spoke to him last September. I have to get up there to find him. After Hanover, we're open to other locations, and would enjoy input. We have ideas on where we want to settle, but no concrete plans. Peter nodded as John filled him in on finding Solange, on their dog, on their plans for New York City and Boston. Those three kids need to come with you. I don't know how excited they will be to leave me and Mel. We've been taking care of them for 5 months. But I can't do it anymore. I'm too old, and they need kids their own age. I guess I should talk to Mel before I speak. She's more their mother than I am their father, but that's my opinion.
How did you find each other?
Matt asked, curious to hear why he was sure the group of five were all that was left of the D.C., Baltimore, and Annapolis area.
You know the story. What happened to the big cities, the curfews, the roundups, particularly here, Peter started. I was in the Navy. I knew what it meant to get rounded up. I saw it in Vietnam. Screw that. I stayed with my wife, stayed with her until she passed. I mourned her. Then I hid for a few weeks. That damn disease was like a brush fire. It killed places in days, maybe a week. It didn't take long for the city to dwindle down to nothing. He looked towards the White House. When the president died, well, that was it. He lasted longer than his cabinet, 2 weeks longer than his wife and daughters. That man was a fighter. When the radio broadcasts announced he was gone and said the military was in charge. That was September, and I was like, what military? Are there 10 of you in a bunker somewhere broadcasting? I hadn't seen a tank or jeep or motorcycle in days. I stayed in my apartment eating dry cereal and canned fruit. The electricity didn't go off until mid-October. I could cook things and keep some food cold in my fridge. I scavenged in my neighborhood, but didn't venture farther than a few houses. I don't eat much. It was easy to stay alive. The streets were empty. The trash smelled horrible. The stench of death and rotting bodies was almost unbearable. But I stayed in my row house in Georgetown. The radio broadcasts went out. I waited another week, and then I got in my car and started driving around. I found the Jones twins breaking into homes and eating out of trash cans. I took them in, gave them a hot meal, set them up in my guest room. They're great kids, a little energetic, but they're smart and respectful. The three of us drove around for another week, and I suggested we take a trip to the ocean. Go over to Annapolis, try to find other people, maybe catch some crabs or fish. We get over there. We're downtown. I want her to go to the harbor and find a boat, maybe take the kids fishing. And we run into Casey and a woman named Barbara Stevens. She wasn't Casey's mother,
but a survivor who found the little girl wandering the streets. Barbara is late-stage breast cancer, lost her chemo when everything went foobar from the rapture. She grimaced with pain at every step, every time she moved, but she'd cared for that little 3-year-old girl with everything she had. He looked at the ground. He choked up for a minute before clearing his throat. Anyway, we meet. I tell her I can help take care of Casey. Barbara comes back to Georgetown with us. Lives for another week, making sure I'm not some sort of pedophile or horrible person, that I really will take care of this sweet little girl. I came into the kitchen on the morning of the 8th day, and she was sitting at the table. She asks me to forgive her. I nodded. I knew what she meant. She weighed 80 pounds by then. She could barely move. She took a bottle of pills and died quietly in a house down the street. Can you imagine? You survive the rapture, but you've got cancer and die anyway. Peter stopped for a moment, pulling a handkerchief from his back pocket to wipe his eyes and blow his nose. Jake and Jackie knew the situation. Just 8 years old, each of them, but they understood. I'm old. I can't take care of Casey all the time. The twins took on most of the responsibility of caring for her. I still cooked, but the twins kept the house clean. They kept Casey entertained. They read to her. They suggest I move a third bed into their room so she can sleep with them. He looked over to the RV. I hope they can play with your kids, get some of their childhood back, whatever they can reclaim after this horror. John put his hand on Peter's upper arm. My son Craig is young. I worry about the same things. He ran away for weeks after the rapture, after his mother died. He plays with his 2 younger cousins like it's a long weekend from school. He gets his work done. He knows the score, what the world is right now. But he also plays. The twins will be okay. You did a great job with them, keeping them alive.
I did what I could, Peter responded, choked up again. I did what needed to be done.
Peter cleared his throat and continued.
A week after Barbara left us, we decided to look for other people. We headed over to Baltimore, and I'm driving around in my car. I installed the car seat for Casey. We have movies going for the kids. I turn a corner, and we almost run over Melanie. She's walking in the middle of the road, crossing the street. I almost mow her down. It was a fine way to introduce myself, driving like a maniac. She's coming back from Johns Hopkins, where she's been trying to keep a baby alive in the NICU. She's a doctor. The baby boy was immune, and in the old world would have made it, but didn't have the lungs to keep himself alive. Mel is walking around like a zombie, having hand-pumped the baby's lungs for 14 hours before she collapsed from exhaustion. The power was out. The generators at the hospital finally failed, and she had to move the little boy from the electric ventilator to a hand ventilator. She couldn't do it alone. She woke up in a chair with the little boy dead in her arms. She was pretty rattled up by it. Peter shook his head. I stop the car, and she gets in. We introduce ourselves, talk about plans, and she comes back to D.C. to help me with the kids. And see what the winter brings. Casey sat on her lap, and I saw a tear roll down Mel's face. We made additional swings through Baltimore and Annapolis, but we haven't found anyone else. If there are other people in D.C., we can't find them. We burned signal fires. We blew horns. No one until you drove up. Mel had the great idea to move to here, near the White House, as these buildings were cleared by the military during the rapture siege. There isn't rotting corpse smell. You don't run into bodies when you look for food. It's a clean zone. It's also how we saw you pull up to the White House. He rubbed his hands and blew into them to warm them up. His ears were getting red as the temperature dropped. So, that's it. That's our story, the abbreviated version. We've had our ups and downs. We've struggled in some areas, but we've kept those kids alive.
We've kept them fed, and Mel has done a nice job trying to get them to read and write.
You're cold, John said, and I hate for you to miss out on my brother's meatballs, if there are any left. Let's go into the RV and get you some food.
Matt put his arm on the old man's shoulder and led him into the RV.
Again, welcome to the group.
Where did you grow up? Are you a native of Washington, D.C.?
Matt opened the door for Peter. The spring shut the door behind them.
John turned and saw Solange standing firm by his side during the conversation.
He is a nice man, she said. He reminds me of my grandfather.
I didn't realize you were still out here. Aren't you cold? You said you hated the cold.
John was surprised she stayed outside instead of going in with Emily, Todd, and the new people.
I wanted to hear his story, and I wanted to make sure you were not left alone outside. It is okay to trust people, but I do not trust people 100%. 4 people standing outside is less of a target than 3. If he was part of a larger group, a scout sent to see our weaknesses, having 3 of us with him was a sign that he or his group could not get us into situations where we might be vulnerable, when there would only be 1 of us.
Thank you, he said, glad another person was thinking of security and wary of survivors.
You are welcome, she said, flashing a smile, the first John had seen her make. She looked down at the ground for a second, almost as if embarrassed to smile at him.
I hope there is still some food. I did not eat very much, and I am hungry.
John opened the door for her.
Let's find out.
He put his hand on her back, an instinctive gesture to help her into the RV. She turned and smiled at him again before going inside. John could hear children's laughter from the RV. The group was talking loudly. The 2 tribes were merging into 1. Sleeping arrangements were complicated. Jackie and Jake wanted to sleep with their new friends on the floor of the RV. Casey was scared to sleep without Melanie. Melanie did not want to sleep on the floor or on a couch. Jay said he would go back to Melanie and Peter's apartment and sleep over with Casey, but Todd and Emily would not let him go alone. Peter described their 3-bedroom apartment, and there appeared to be more than enough room for a few children and at least 2 adults. Todd and Emily went with Jay, Casey, Melanie, and Peter to sleep at the apartment. Jake, Jackie, Brian, and Craig slept in sleeping bags on the floor of the RV. Matt slept on the couch. Solange slept in the large bed in the bedroom of the RV. John slept on the pullout. Before they split up for the evening, Peter and Melanie agreed to travel to Hanover. Peter was a man who made decisions quickly, and after eating his meal and seeing how well the children played together, he took Melanie aside and asked her if she was willing to join the new group.
I don't like being cold, Peter.
You know that. But you're right. This is the best scenario for us and the children. I want to bring our own vehicle so we have options, but staying with this family seems like a good idea.
I like them, and I trust them after just 1 meal.
Peter announced his decision to join the Dixon tribe and suggested they leave for New York as soon as the next day. Emily protested immediately.
If you think I'm leaving before I tour the White House and show my kids Washington, D.C., well, you are mistaken. Part of this trip is creating memories.
You know what? Peter admitted. I've never toured the White House. I'd like to do that before I leave. It's also been a few years since I walked the wall. I would like to say goodbye.
Peter typically avoided the Vietnam Memorial, as he knew too many names etched into the black stone.
Part of our plan is to take the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution with us if we can. We're also open to art, so if you see anything or remember anything from the National Gallery or during your White House tour, grab it.
Melanie had not considered taking art with her. She loved art and was a patron at most of the museums in town.
We should take these things, preserve as much of the world as we can.
She turned to Peter.
With new people come new ideas.
The tribe agreed on at least 1 week of sightseeing and playing before departing for the next city, Philadelphia. John spoke with Emily and Todd before splitting up for the night.
What do you think?
What do I think about what? The people? They're smart, hard-working, honest people who want to join us. There's no downside to this scenario, Emily told him bluntly. She had no time for conspiracy theories or distrust. I agree. I'm very comfortable with all of them. But I don't want Craig, Jay, or Brian left alone with anyone, John replied.
John, that's just parenting etiquette. Do you really think I'm going to ask Peter to look after my young kids?
Todd was annoyed with his brother.
Look, I appreciate that you're looking after us, but I don't think there's anything sinister happening here. If there is, I trust that you have it under control.
Okay, I'll lighten up. But please try to elevate your senses a little. We're not in Raleigh, a place you combed for survivors. We're in a huge metro area. There could be a bad person or people.
You're right. And that is a reasonable statement. I don't think the new people are bad, but there could be another person out there.
I'll keep a gun with me, and I will have my walkie-talkie turned on all the time. Todd conceded John's fears as he and Emily prepared for their evening away.
We'll see you back here tomorrow morning. Make sure you have eggs and milk ready for us when we get back.
Emily patted John on the back. If we're here for a week, we're setting the pizza oven up first thing tomorrow morning. It's only been 2 days, but I'm already jonesing for some fresh bread. John gave Todd a hug.
I will make fresh dough in the morning. You, Matt, and I will get it set up after breakfast.
The parties split up for the night. Solange was the only person who protested her sleeping arrangements.
I am new to the group. Why do I deserve the big bed?
John calmed her protests. Sol, there will be plenty of time for you to sleep uncomfortably. Take the high points when you can get them. She relented and went to sleep, happy in her big bed. She was ecstatic to sleep with people for the first time in 6 months. The morning was chaotic. The Jones twins woke up early, very early, waking the rest of the RV in the process. It was only 6 a.m. and still dark outside. John would not let the kids play on the White House lawn. He put a movie on the television and made himself coffee. Matt, kicked off his couch by the kids watching television, moved to the converted third-row bed in the Suburban. He mumbled something about needing more rest, put on a winter cap, and stormed out of the RV. John sat, sipping his second mug of coffee, reprimanding the constant screaming and fart, butt, and poop comments from the four kids. The bedroom door opened at 6:30. Solange emerged, fully dressed and put together for the day. She sat down with John at the small dining room table.
"Tonight I suggest the kids go to the apartment, or we get a turn in the apartment."
She smiled at him.
"Is there enough coffee for me to have a cup?"
"I would never deny another person coffee. I'm not a savage yet. Please help yourself, now and always." She poured herself a cup and spoke to John as if there were no kids screaming at the top of their lungs at the cartoon movie.
"So few people left. We do not have much to build a new world."
She took a sip of her black coffee. John pointed to the sugar and a small bottle of milk on the table. She shook her head.
"On our trip here, you said we might grow to 20 by the time we arrived in New York.
I believe we will be lucky to have 20 after New York." "I know. We'll be pressed to find better people than the five we just met, but it would be nice to find stronger hands. A doctor is a fantastic addition, but taking on 3 more children and an older man, the tribe is going backwards."
"Less alpha males means less threats, but you are right. We also sacrifice strength. Peter is a leader, but he is also wise and silent. He will not cause trouble."
John looked at her after the alpha male comment.
"You're an interesting person, Solange.
I know why I'm paranoid, but why are you so distrusting of others?"
Solange took a sip of her coffee. "I was not the only survivor in Richmond. There was another person, a man, young, my age. He was a local man and did not go to college. He drove around trying to find survivors in a big black pickup truck. It was November, late November, and I had not seen anyone for months. The first time I saw his truck, I let it drive by. I am a young woman,
and I cannot defend myself. But after months of solitude, I decided to trust the driver. She paused and looked at John with vacant, distant eyes. It was a decision based on my selfish needs, not safety. I will not make a mistake like that again. The boy, his name was Fred, just Fred. He never told me his full name, let me in his truck, told me his survival story. Something about being a kindergarten teacher, living with his parents to help them with money. I think this story was a lie. I do not know for sure. He asked me to tell him my story. I stupidly told him about how I was alone, how I was not from the area. He drove while I tell him things. I did not realize, but he drove in circles and zigzags. She sipped her coffee. After 30 minutes, I have no idea where I am, where he has taken me. It is not close to the highway. It is not near town. Even though I later found my way back to Richmond, I could not take you to where I was. She glanced at the children to make sure they were not listening. It is best they do not hear my story. I did not want Matt to hear it either. He is too young to know such evil. John gave a polite nod of acceptance. We stop at a house on a small farm. It looks run down, but there are many nice things, things Fred stole or took after the rapture. I was driving a nice car. We all have things now. I was not concerned about the nice things. I was scared that I was alone with him, and we were in a place I did not know, and I had no way to leave the place. But I am young, and I was more trusting 5 months ago. I told myself I was being silly. There was a pond next to the house. He said there were fish in the pond, great for eating. He told me to take a fishing pole, catch him fish for dinner. I was confused, and I asked him what he was talking about. He raised his voice to me and said, "You see all this stuff? It's mine. The rapture has given it to me and made me a king. I am in charge, and you will do what I say or things will go badly for you. Take a pole, dig for some worms, catch me a damn fish before I beat you." She did not raise her own voice while retelling the story. She kept a natural tone, as if the events happened to a different person. John stared at her. She maintained a distant look in her eyes. "I am so sorry," he said, putting his hand on her hand resting on the table. "If the children start to listen, I will stop. I will not let them hear my story." She nodded her head in their direction. "So Mr. Fred sits down on his porch and stares at me. He has a small refrigerator on the porch plugged into a generator, and he pulls out a beer and starts to drink. I say to myself, 'Sol, this is bad. You cannot run or walk away right now. You need to smile and do what he says.' So I take one of the fishing poles leaning against the shack. I pull up a few of the flagstones on the dirt walkway, find a worm, hook the worm, and throw it into the pond. I fished with my father in Ecuador. I know where to find worms, how to catch fish. I catch a fish. I reel it in. I hold it up to show it to him. This Fred, he walks over to me. He looks at the fish, and he punches me in the stomach, very hard. I drop on the ground in pain, coughing. I have tears in my eyes, but I do not cry. He yells at me, 'You think a fish that tiny is going to feed me? Try again. I will not punch you in the face. You are too pretty to look at, but I will punch you in the gut until you get it right.' I am dirty and thirsty and tell him I will try again. I ask for a glass of water. 'You want something from me when you cannot even catch me a big enough fish to eat? You can drink the water from the pond.' I tell him that I have water in my pack, my water, not his. He walks over to his truck, takes my pack out, and throws it into the pond. 'I own everything. I own you. You will drink and eat when I say. You will earn your food and water. You catch me a fish, and I will tell you how you can earn food.' I drank the water from the pond, and I did not eat for 3 days. You can guess how he wanted me to earn my food. He said he did not want to rape me, that he was not interested in that. He wanted me to want to be with him. He thought making me be with him for food was different than raping me. Fred was a strong man. He worked with his hands before the rapture. He was a little heavy, and his arm muscles were very big. When he punched me in the stomach, it hurt me. I decided to die on my feet. I went to him the third night. I caught him 3 fish and held them up for his approval. He stood in front of me. I could smell the beer on his breath. He nodded at me. I lifted my knee to his groin with as much strength as I had. He was not expecting the move, and he went down coughing. I jumped on him, putting my hands around his throat, squeezing as hard as I could. This Fred, he was strong, but he lacked determination. I do not. He swung his arms wildly, hitting me all over. I clung to his throat, staring into his eyes. When he tried to get up, I kneed him in the groin as hard as I could, over and over, holding his throat, keeping my grip as tightly as I could. His eyes were filled with terror. His head and face turned red, then purple. His punches became weak. I clung to his throat long after he stopped moving. I kneed him in the groin even when his eyes were shut and he no longer flinched. I held on to his throat until my hands ached. She took a sip of coffee, looking at John calmly. As I said, I possess determination and strength of will. Fred was a weak-minded, stupid beta dog. The rapture set him free for a little while and made him think he could act like an alpha dog. When I was killing him, he became the beta again. He submitted to me, like weak people do. He pretended to be something he was not. Solange looked at the children again, making sure they were not listening. An alpha would have taken me, not played some game to make me earn my food. This new world does not accept weakness or stupidity. I was stupid to get into that truck, but my strength set me free. She took a final sip, calmly setting the mug on the table. I fished my pack out of the pond. I dragged his body off the porch and put it into the pond. I cooked the fish I caught for him. I ate his food. I drank his beer, wincing as it burned on my bloody lips. I woke up early the next day and used Fred's truck, following the sunrise east to the highway. When I got back to campus, I moved into a nicer house, lived there for 5 more months. And now, you have found me. John's coffee was gone. He did not refill his cup. Solange got up, walked to the pot, and brought it back to the table. She filled his mug and set the pot back on the coffee maker. She sat down, put a spoonful of sugar and milk in his coffee, and stirred it with a spoon to mix. El Encantado did not rid the world of evil. I learned that lesson the hard way. John did not respond. He sat at the table with her. After a sip of the coffee she poured for him, he spoke. If you put the sugar in before the coffee, it melts and tastes better. I will know for next time. Solange put her hand on top of his hand, similar to his earlier gesture. Thank you for listening to me, John Dixon. And thank you for being a good man. John smiled at her, but it was his turn to look down quickly, uncomfortable with the exchange. He even blushed. A young woman, almost half his age, whom he had just met the afternoon before, was touching his hand. He could sense a connection, but he did not believe she could have feelings for a man his age, particularly after only one day. John chalked up the touch and exchange of smiles as innocent.
At 7:30, the door to the RV flew open, and Jay jumped inside.
"Their apartment is awesome! They have a fireplace and tons of blankets and books and games and stuff. It's